Hello everyone, my name's Paul Hobson and I'm the director of the Contemporary Art Society. And it's my very great pleasure to chair tonight's debate, which is the second in a series of debates organised for artists collaboratively, very happily, I have to say, between ArtQuest, the Contemporary Art Society and DAX. And it's called The New Economy of Art, the series as a whole. And what we're aiming to do in this series of debates is to exchange knowledge and experience with artists and to open up insight into some of the current rapid and significant developments in the arts sector in order to better enable artists and also those who are stakeholders in artists to understand and to influence the evolving cultural ecologies and economies in which we all operate. The first debate was, for those of you that weren't here, was held in October, and it considered a range of impacts on artists as a result of the shrinking of public funding. And then the next debate, which will be held here again on Wednesday the 13th of June, so please chisel that in your diaries, will examine the shifting model and agendas of cultural institutions and what this may mean for artists also. But tonight, in Market Matters, we'll be looking at commercial representation. And our purpose in this debate is to try to articulate some of the recent developments within the art market and related factors which influence models of representation, both commercial and critical in recent years, and to speculate on future market conditions and what these might mean for artists. So we'll look at the influence of the art market on the visual arts sector and try to understand how precisely this operates and what its implications are for artists. So aspects of this that I imagine we might touch upon will include the close relationships and the interdependencies between commercial galleries and public institutions and their programs, for example, the ascendancy of the International Art Fair, and the exclusive and self-interested character of this highly influential network, what this means for artists. The impact on art of art fairs on traditional forms of commercial gallery models, and what this means in terms of critical representation for gallery artists, for example. The co-opting of international art events and biennials into commercial market functions, and the forms and influences of privatization of historically so-called publicly subsidized art, the publicly subsidized art sector. So we'll reconsider in fact what the likely effects are of a reduction of public subsidy, programming and commissioning, for example, and its relationship to commercial representation. And we'll explore some of the options, I hope, if we have time, you'll see that we have quite a wide topic, to look at what are the new models, if you like, that are available for artists to sustain their practice and ask if, for example, online platforms are ways of being visible and selling art, if they're new kinds of economies that can be useful for artists, and what are these? Now, we're very aware as a panel that there will be many, many different types of artists in the room here tonight and very different options that are available for commercial representation. And the number of artists that may be here may be very small that are commercially represented by galleries. It's a tiny percentage, of course, that are represented by critically engaged, internationally active galleries within the art market. And, of course, there are other forms of sustaining practice through selling and other models. I imagine the majority of artists here may not even be represented by commercial galleries, may well be artists for whom commercial representation is neither appropriate or even desirable, and of course we'll have many freelance practitioners here as well. And I think we'd really like to hear about your perspective on the market, how you're operating commercially within this debate, what your experience, both the challenges and the opportunities are of the current situation. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers, whom I hope will enable us to illuminate some of these questions, even if just some of these questions. Tonight's keynote speaker is Louisa Buck. And I'm sure many of you will know that Louisa is a writer and broadcaster on contemporary art. She's the London contemporary art columnist for the Art newspaper, as well as a regular reviewer on BBC Radio and TV. Louisa's written extensively, very widely, on the art market, including co-authoring with Judith Greer, Owning Art, The Contemporary Art Collector's Handbook, and her latest book, A Place for Art, The Contemporary Art Commissioner's Handbook, lots of handbooks, will be published by Thames and Hudson later this year. Then we have Kate McGarry here to my left, who's the founder and director of a contemporary art gallery in Shoreditch. I'm sure many of you will know that. The gallery was established in 2002 and represents international artists, including Goshka Mushuga, Dr. Lacra, Francis Hugh Pritchard, Marcus Coates. There's a show there at the moment. And before opening the gallery, Kate worked on various projects in the visual arts for about 8 years, most recently as a curator of a private collection and as a coordinator of projects with artists in public spaces. And then to my far left, Matt Roberts, who's a curator, lecturer, and visual arts correspondent. He's also the founder of Matt Roberts Arts, a non-profit organization dedicated to providing practical advice, career advice to artists. And Matt's exhibited over 500 artists at galleries across the UK, Sweden, Denmark, and Israel, and also has helped to establish the Airspace Gallery in Stoke-on-Trent. Welcome to you all. Thank you for lending your expertise and your experience tonight. Tonight, this really is a debate, so we really do want to have your comments. The format of the evening is that Louisa will give a keynote address for about 20 minutes, and then Kate and Matt will respond to some of the points and the observations that Louisa's made. We'll have a short conversation amongst ourselves, and then we are very keen to have your questions and to get a feel for what your views are on the topic of commercial representation. So, with no further ado, I hand over to Louisa. Thank you.
I shall go and stand at the podium, which is apparently where I've been commanded to give the grand-sounding keynote speech. Hello, everybody. Well, I'm kicking off with the fact that in 2004, I was commissioned by the Arts Council to write a study of the dynamics and components of the contemporary art market in England, and it was also called Market Matters. And I think that it's apposite that we're using this title for this session tonight, because 8 years on, it really is a very important sector to look back at this chunk of time and see how 8 years on, global gloom and despondency notwithstanding, the art market has become greater. The market really does matter. It's shaped the art world, it's shaped its sectors, and it's affecting constantly not only how, but what art is shown and how it's perceived. So I think it's interesting to note that even though everybody's been gloomily watching the markets fall and rise and fall and rise, there's been much nail-biting over the Frieze Art Fair, at the global international end, the art market has continued to proliferate. Certainly back in 2004, when I wrote Market Matters, subprime was still a distant smudge on the horizon, and we had the launch of the publication Market Matters at the second Frieze Art Fair, and there was still some uncertainty then as to whether Frieze Art Fair actually had any legs to run with. And of course, what's so fascinating now is that this year, Frieze is launching in New York in May. It's got an old master's arm in October, and the art market is continuing to survive, not only survive, but absolutely boom, with commercial galleries at the top end especially continuing to expand and open new spaces. Since 2004, really the landscape's changed even in London massively. I mean, Sadie Coles, Pilar Carreras, Kate, Hotel, Hauser & Wirth, White Cube have all opened big new spaces. So you've got this sense now, in October, of a contemporary art week, or 2 weeks in London, which again, you know, is a really recent phenomenon. It seems like it's been here forever, but you've got this sense of this whole kind of explosion taking place, really in an extraordinarily short space of time. And the benefit of this, of course, is that contemporary art has entered the public consciousness in a way which, you know, seemed almost impossible back when I started writing about art in the early 80s. It's entered the cultural mainstream in a way that really would have been unthinkable. And you now have this extraordinary audience of curators, of collectors, of critics who come into London for this particular time, but then, of course, they go away again. And actually, one of the big disadvantages of this huge, wondrous explosion of Frieze Art Fair and all it begins is that it's had a very lasting impact on the kind of attendance and the dynamic of galleries within London having their programme of shows, and indeed the public sector also scheduling its programmes. I mean, I remember interviewing Nicholas Sirota for my owning art book and him saying, really quite grumpily, and this was about 5 or 6 years ago, we now have to completely organise Tate's schedule around the arrival of Frieze and around that Frieze week, to the extent they even open up, you know, the Turbine Hall to coincide with everybody coming into town. So you've got this sense of this whole kind of adjustment now of the terrain to focus around these big sort of flashy fairs. And the art fair expansion isn't just within the UK, where we also now have affordable art fair and a new art fair that's going to be opening in Earl's Court and indeed the Islington Art Fair as well. It's also global. The affordable art fair is now opening up branches in Hong Kong and elsewhere. It's had a mixed impact, in a way, in the cities where they take place, these fairs, because they focus on the local community, but then, as I said, they're these kind of one-stop events. And I think there's a mixed advantage for art fairs and galleries. I mean, first of all, of course, it's only a small proportion of galleries that actually get accepted to come within art fairs. But if you are within an art fair as a gallery, it's a very useful way for you to raise your profile. And I'm sure Kate will be talking about that as well. But it is very helpful to expand your market, to open up your artists and expose them to different sectors. And certainly for galleries outside London especially, it's been very useful. I'm thinking of Workplace in Gateshead, Moot in Nottingham, International 3 in Birmingham, all been beneficiaries. But of course, what's key is that they were actually publicly subsidised to go and show in these art fairs and to build the UK's global profile. And of course, these public funds are probably not going to be nearly so in evidence. The other problem about art fairs, and I will be talking about other things as well, but this is a major change in the last 8 years since I wrote that first publication, Market Matters. The other thing about art fairs is that they do put huge pressure on artists. Now, you might say in the audience, well, it's damn lucky if you're represented by a gallery and you're being promoted at an art fair. But actually, the problem with art fairs is that they put an enormous amount of pressure on artists to produce the new work, to actually keep presenting a showcase for their artworks across these various different kinds of programmes and schedules. And it puts a great deal of pressure on artists to be producing new and fresh works, which is quite funny because when I first started writing about contemporary art, art fairs were kind of grubby, trade-only events that dealers went to and kind of swapped secondary market pieces and actually didn't really involve living artists at all. Now it's completely the opposite. And artists, on the one hand, are quite annoyed if their work isn't put in their gallery's art fair representation, but on the other hand, of course, it does put a great deal of pressure on them to produce new work and to keep that kind of momentum going. Now, the proliferation of art fairs has gone hand in hand across the art world with a vast increase in biennials and triennials from Guangzhou to Dubai, from Moscow to Folkestone. Now, these triennials, biennials, again, are very complex affairs because, on the one hand, they're publicly curated, they're independently curated events which can be crucial in raising profile not only of international artists, but also local artists can piggyback on these events. But it's often very hard to tell the difference between biennials and triennials and the art fairs which often accompany them. There's an awful lot of cross-dressing going on these days in the art world. That a biennial, for example, like the Venice Biennial, which is a time-honoured 175-year institution, nonetheless, work gets sold out of the pavilions. Work gets sold in the various exhibitions throughout the biennial. And then, of course, you've got the big art fairs that then often accompany or come quite close, and they have curated shows. They have shows which perhaps don't look like they're there for a commercial purpose, but 9 times out of 10, it's the galleries that are represented in the art fairs that are actually putting on these shows. Or they'll have special artist projects. Mike Nelson, for example, was shortlisted for the Turner Prize on the strength of a Frieze art fair project, which wasn't for sale. But in fact, there was various negotiations, and eventually it did get acquired by somebody. But it wasn't officially for sale in the first place. Roman Ondak, another Frieze project, had a performative piece which was a queue, which again wasn't officially for sale, but somehow the Tate did actually buy it because the gallery who promoted the piece then were approached by Tate, and Tate actually acquired it. So you've got this very kind of complex terrain of interlocking sort of agendas. Which leads me on to another key development, which Paul touched on in his introduction in the last sort of near decade, which is the ever more close and intimate intertwining of the so-called public and the private and commercial sectors. And there's more cross-dressing going on here. I mean, if you go to White Cube in Bermondsey, it has a complete institutional feel to it. These enormous expanses of polished concrete, these vast Anselm Kiefer sculptures, publications, libraries, research spaces, screening rooms, I mean, to all intents and purposes, and significantly free entry, of course, as well. So you have this sense of sort of institutional feel. You go to Victoria Mirror, you go to Hauser and Wirth, you go to Gagosian in Britannia Street and see enormous Richard Serra sculptures for which the space was actually initially designed, and you will see often large and showy pieces, installations which are often loss leaders for these organisations in circumstances which completely vie with institutional surroundings. So you have this sense, on the other hand, of public spaces with their retail outlets, with their keenly observed attendance figures at their exhibitions, with the worrying and fretting about what's to go into the gift shop, what's to go into the cafe, looking more and more like retail outlets. Curators now in public institutions have to be very proactive in their courting of patrons, in their courting of sponsors. It's as much a curator's job now to find supporters for their shows and people who will back and endorse and indeed donate as it is to actually keep up to breath with what's going on in the developments in the art world. So you have this, again, this very complex kind of interrelationship, also with commercial galleries, who play a very crucial part in the kind of general landscape of our public institutions. I mean, public commercial galleries will underwrite exhibitions, often by helping with shipping, by helping with catalogues, by helping with asking collectors to donate, and quite often artworks are actually sold out of institutional shows. So you have the sense, if you like, for example, Peter Doig at Tate Britain, there was work straight from the studio in Trinidad, and quite a few of those works actually were sold during the duration of the exhibition, but of course the Tate didn't get any percentage on that. The Tate is not a retail outlet, but nonetheless it provided a very good showcase for work that was for sale and to be available on the market. And then, of course, you've got the other element, which is a very key development across the kind of wider global art world, which is the collector. Now, of course, global economy being as it is, collectors are not so flashily splashing their money around as they were, and are very keen to be seen to be supporting artists, perhaps, rather than purchasing whole scale. There's been rather a good, I think, Darwinian kind of carving away of a lot of the kind of hedge fund speculation on artworks. That kind of element has died away. But nonetheless, there are a lot of very rich people out there, and a lot of very rich people also with a keen eye for a tax break, who are setting up their own private foundations, who are setting up their own showing spaces that have obvious tax benefits, but which also have educational programs, publications, and so on as well. I'm thinking of Parasol Unit, I'm thinking of Anita Zabludovich, I'm thinking of a whole range of these kind of, across the globe, of these kind of philanthropic individuals. Now, perhaps I sound a bit cynical, because of course they do a great job in promoting and showing the work of artists, and indeed of purchasing artists, but also, of course, there's a problem where you get the interface with the public institutions, which in the past they would have donated work to. Now often they're almost in direct rivalry with them, because they'll be bidding for the same work, wanting the same works from art, from gallery shows, and indeed putting on exhibitions that often have similar sort of resonances, but also they'll lend works as well to institutions. So you've got this very kind of complicated interface going on. So now, while this situation of extended art fairs, of high-end galleries increasing their spaces, of high-rolling collectors setting up their foundations, of art fairs proliferating over the world, which has certainly increased over the last few years, it's made it a lot easier to see art. It's made it a lot easier, perhaps, if you've got some surplus income, to buy it. Except for a tiny proportion at the top of the pile, it's really far from favourable to artists. You know, there are a great many galleries and there are a great many artists who are completely outside this ecosystem. We can all visit Frieze and pay our £12. We can all go and look in these galleries. We can all investigate the various institutional shows and look at who's paid for or subsidised the catalogue. But it does seem like a very closed shop, I think, to a great extent, to many people outside. Even though the internet, of course, has expanded massively the potential of being able to interface with an art market, with things like the VIP art fair, and indeed the auction houses now do much more online bidding, it's still a very kind of high-end, high-rolling context. And I think the internet actually I'm interested to see what the other panelists think about this, but I feel the internet is going to be a useful tool, but it's never going to be a substitute to experiencing art directly. It's a convenient means, it's a convenient research tool, but something like the VIP art fair, it did well, but I still think the physical actuality, these event-based activities are the ones that are actually still going to hold sway. But what does give me cause for some optimism is another interesting development that's happened since 2004. And well, it's certainly not new, but it's gained momentum since then. And that's the not-for-profit artist-run space organisation in London. The fact that in this climate, artists are getting more and more nimble about combining, about setting up studio-based exhibition spaces. I'm thinking of Coexist in a converted waterworks in Southend, Aid and Abet in Cambridge, which is an organisation which provides a creative platform for artists to show and to cross-reference, work across disciplines, and to share information. Trove in Birmingham's another one, Platform A in Middlesbrough. Now, they've always been artist-run spaces, of course, and they've always been artist studios with showing spaces attached to them. But I think these spaces are particularly interesting because artists are coming together in a very professional way without looking overly slick and commercialised. They do interface with local markets. They do interface with other arts bodies and indeed other artists, and often have exchanges with artistic groups or with other artists across the board. What's also interesting about a lot of these spaces is that they specialise or have a particular sympathy towards multimedia work, installation work, performative work, work which isn't so market-friendly. The market pays lip service to these kind of art forms, but actually the problem with the market, one of the many problems with the market, is that it privileges a certain kind of art practice. There's always this talk about painting is back. Well, painting's never been away because painting is very easy to sell. I'm not in any way decrying painting, but I'm saying that if you go around an art fair or a gallery, apart from perhaps a kind of an installation-based performative moment that they might have occasionally to kind of beef things up, you have to have regular stock to sell. And I think, you know, some galleries like Kate, of course, will work with artists who work with performance, but there has to be a residue from that performance, and that kind of work is difficult to sustain on a constant market basis. And art fairs do not help that, auction houses do not help that, but these kind of artist-run groups do provide a great deal of support for that kind of work. Also, I've noticed a rise in the role of artist residencies, which I think is interesting, that the role of the residency is becoming more and more prominent. Artist groups, not just in the UK, but actually across the globe, are seeing this as a very useful model to build audiences, for artists to interface with each other, to make work and to show work and to actually interconnect. And I think this whole kind of residency model is something that's relatively inexpensive in the grand scheme of things. It's something that also institutions are specialising in more, with artists coming to do research-based residencies and various kinds of activities within that, which keeps the programme fresh and keeps the costs low, but provides a means for artists to interface. So I think that, you know, one of the questions that Paul asked when we were talking initially about this conversation, about this talk a few weeks ago, was, you know, how will we see the art world in 5 years' time? And of course, you know, none of us got a crystal ball, none of us know what terrible kind of troughs and peaks might occur with across the economy. But I think that this kind of global jamboree isn't going to go away, because I think emerging markets where the economies are not so fragile, I'm thinking the Middle East, I'm thinking China, I'm thinking India, certainly is taking and running with the art market ball in the kind of art market event-based spectacular way. But what's interesting is that these new art markets, as well as the ones back home, the more developed ones if you like, are all concentrating more on collaborative, on this residential model, on these kind of project-based models as well, because the market's smart enough to see that it can't vacuum pack itself into kind of commodified sanitation, that it needs the lifeblood, it needs the pulse of real artworks, it needs to work with local artists. So even though you might have international art fairs rolling into town, I think more and more you're having affiliations. This is happening with the Dubai art fair that's opening in a few days' time. They're making a point of working also with local artist groups and local artist studios. So, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. Of course, with art school fees escalating to a perspective point of horror, it's going to be more and more difficult for people to train as artists, with, as I said, the economy being as it is, it's more and more difficult for all of us to live, and artists particularly who operate, as many of you know, at the sharp end of all these kind of developments. But I think that along with the global razzmatazz that does raise the profile, I think that these kind of more collaborative, more durational, more grassroots initiatives are going to continue to gather momentum and continue to grow apace. And I also think that this model of philanthropy that is developing with collectors and individuals becoming more and more, private individuals becoming more and more involved, I think that there is a sense, if you like, an investment in being seen to be philanthropic and not just to acquire, not just to own. So actually, if you're collecting art, it is more and more seemly and appropriate to be seen supporting art. And many collectors do feel very strongly that this is the way that they need to go as well. So I've flung a kind of mad smorgasbord of stuff out into the audience, but hopefully this gives a vague idea about the sort of the key areas I feel that the art world is developing within and how perhaps it can be helpful to different sectors who aren't just within the kind of top gilded Gagosian and white cube gallery list. So thanks very much, and we'll go over to the panel now.
Louisa, thank you. You managed to talk about everything I think that we talked about, which is quite incredible.
Ram-raided through.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Lots of things for us to be thinking about and hopefully talking about with you all shortly. But I'd now like to invite Kate McGarry to respond from your perspective.
Thank you. I'm going to respond to some of the points Louisa's made. I'll give you a little bit of background about how I started my gallery. I worked a little bit in the public sector, where I raised money for artist projects. So I got grants from the Arts Council. And I also got private money to help fund certain artist projects. And what's come around, having had the gallery for 10 years, is that actually my job then isn't that different to the one I have now. Of course, in that time, in 10 years, when I first opened the gallery, there was a very different scene in London. It was 2002. Frieze Art Fair hadn't begun. I have a sort of romantic vision of that time in that collectors used to come to the gallery and actually sit with me and talk to me about art and would eventually maybe buy something. And what seems to me that's happened is there's just this tremendous speeding up with everything. But that's the world we live in. And I suppose, you know, art fairs, I love them and I hate them. They are a necessity, I think. I mean, I don't think I could have the gallery and represent the artists that I do without them. Having said that, I did seven art fairs last year. I sort of lost my mind momentarily. And, you know, I think it had quite a derogative effect on me and probably on my artists, actually. Because I think what is great about the business I'm in, if you like, is that I think it's, I think really good quality tends to come out. I think, however many art fairs you rush to, you need to really be working on each project in a sort of sustainable way. And art fairs can only do so much. So this year I'm going to focus on two art fairs and try and, I'm really keen at the moment to sort of bring the focus back to the gallery space. So, there's been a lot of talk about art fairs, but I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I remember with the very first Frieze, I was in the very first Frieze, the gallery was about 8 months old. It was tremendously exciting. And Frieze has changed the landscape of London. I mean, we call it Frieze Week. Apparently, Frieze aren't that pleased with it being called Frieze Week, but I can't see why not. But that's what it's called. And I think it's bought an international... eyes are on London for that week, but at the same time it can be quite a difficult time to have an exhibition if you're not an artist or you're not Gagosian, you're not Hazel and Verth. It's so distracting that actually it can be a kind of overwhelming time. It's sort of a bit like having lunch with 50 people and trying to have a good conversation with them all. I mean, you know, rather than sitting down with one person and so I'm, you know, they... In the defence of art fairs, obviously things happen through them, and collectors have changed their way of behaving in that they, you know, maybe once they would have come to the gallery, they tend to dash from one art fair to the next now. I have one collector who never goes to art fairs. He always gets the best pieces from me. He always comes on a quiet day when the gallery is actually closed. And I think there's something in that, you know, this speeding up is something quite negative. What else can I say about art fairs? I made a few notes here in response. I mean, one other point there. Last year, I mean, I think the nice thing about them is that I've done Turin Art Fair twice. There's a very good collector base in Turin. It's the kind of main city for art in Italy. And I've done it three times over in the 10 years. And I don't have to be there every year, but I mean, this business is all about sustaining relationships. And I think in a way, a gallerist's job is not that different from an artist in that, you know, the people that you pick up along the way can become more and more important as things develop. And I think that people I met on maybe the first week of opening the gallery are still very much part of my picture, you know. And I think in many ways, you know, I often think that as a gallery, you need several people to support you, and that can be enough to sustain quite a lot for artists. And I think as an artist, it's very similar. If you've got good people supporting you, you can count them on one hand, and it can be enough to actually create a career, which can sustain over several years. I do believe that. And I think a lot of the galleries, you know, we're all chasing after the same collectors a lot of the time. It's all about personal relationships. So art fairs have facilitated that because they actually, you know, not only do sales take place, but actually, you know, museum shows can be agreed at an art fair. And whether it's that someone comes and they've been meaning to talk to you about an artist, and then, you know, the conversation happens there and then, so they bring a huge amount of, you know, the chemistry that is happening anyway is brought to the fore at an art fair. And so they have that function. I just feel that with so many new ones opening, we can only take so much as gallerists and as an audience walking around Frieze. I didn't do Frieze one year. The second year, I didn't do it. And I just came as a visitor, and I was so exhausting. I thought, well, at least as a gallerist, you've got somewhere to sit, you know. But it's... they're part of our future, I don't think. I'm not sure what will happen, but I think they're here to stay for the next... don't want to say. Hong Kong, I did Hong Kong Art Fair last year. And again, you know, it's about relationships. You can't go cold somewhere, take new artists that the audience have never seen and expect to sell. I mean, you know, they were very much buying Chinese collectors. It seemed to me were buying Louise Bourgeois and Damien Hirst. So, you know, I've got a lot of work to do there if I'm going to foster collectors in Hong Kong. It's not a sort of quick, easy, quick sale. But, you know, that is maybe something for the future. I'm not going to go back this year. I'm going to save my energy. But I probably will go back in the future. Let's see what happens. What else can I add about art fairs? I suppose that leads into the online thing. I tried the online art fair, VIP art fair. I did that both years, actually. I mean, obviously the internet is a tool. I use it, having a website for the gallery. I mean, there was a time when it was kind of not cool for artists to have websites, I don't know. You know, but that was probably pre me having the gallery. I remember there was, you know, some discussion amongst my artists, should I or shouldn't I have a website? Some of my artists do, some of them don't. Of course, almost everybody has one now, and it's a very useful tool. It's a very useful way for me to see an artist practice, but it's only ever a starting point. And I think the VIP art fair was a communication tool for me. Sales did come from it, very few, but it's really a sort of advertising platform. But actually what it did was I chose this year to put my current show onto VIP. So I literally had my current show up, and it gave people the opportunity to then come and see the show in the flesh, and that worked. So I think you're right. I think, you know, it's not a replacement for seeing real work. And sales I have made through it, everyone has already known the artist practice and seen the works in the flesh. So, but I think it's definitely a big part of the future. I don't think, you know, if you said auction houses are using, sales are happening online. And there are new models coming. One is called Artsy. Well, there's been a bit of press about Artsy. I've actually seen that, and it's actually quite beautifully done. I think the online art fair was a bit clunky, and they had some problems in the beginning, but Artsy is sort of by invitation only. It's quite strange. It's not gallery led. It's image led. So you can search for you can search under themes. You can search art with skulls in. Sounds kind of terrible, but actually the reality of it is it's quite a nice tool actually. And I suddenly, when I heard about it, I was quite sort of reticent. But it could be quite an interesting way forward for the way people search for images, I think, online. But until you see it, I'm not going to be able to convince you. What was interesting about VIP Art Fair was the sort of funny parallels that it did have with a real art fair. The first year, it didn't work. Sort of, it was almost like they invited too many people and it couldn't fit everybody in. You get a lot of people trying to get you to advertise in magazines while you're sitting on the stand. My chat function, I kept getting people trying to sell me advertising. There are a lot of parallels, and I think it can only do so much, but what it does do is it creates, which all art fairs do, they create a kind of a momentum which collectors respond to. So they give collectors a kind of a deadline, whereby it's an event, it's a festival, and if you don't act now, it's an opportunity to take good works. And they are very valuable, because we seem to have shifted to this idea that, although I must say that the sort of the desire to consume seems to, since it's kind of dialed down in not just with the art fairs, but sort of generally, it's selling art for me is more rewarding now than it was. And actually, the whole boom and all the sort of talk we hear about all the expanse in the galleries, and actually felt quite disenfranchised by that, by the whole boom thing, really. I mean, I was probably very lucky. I started the gallery at a time I didn't really realise we were coming into this huge growth period. But, all the talk of big prices and things doesn't have a huge bearing on what I'm doing, And I think generally, you're working as an agent, really, for the artists. I mean, if a taxi driver says, what do? I tend to avoid the art gallery thing. I just say, I'm an agent, because that is really what I am. That's really just sustains throughout. Art fairs or not.
That's great. Okay, I think we'll hand over to Matt now. Matt.
Right. although I've curated exhibitions and partnered with commercial galleries fairly regularly and worked with artists who have representation, I'd have to say the larger part of my experience is meeting with, doing professional development, one-to-one sessions with artists who aren't represented for whatever reason. In recent times, over the last couple of years, through doing these face-to-face sessions, there seems to be an increased interest in how to gain representation, what representation means, what opportunities lie outside of the public sphere. Now, I'm not sure what actually underlies that trend. Maybe it's a loss of faith in public funding, with so many publicised cases of funding going elsewhere or being reduced. Maybe there's always been, or at least in recent times, there's a lack of education or a lack of awareness of the commercial sector. It remains mysterious, opaque. People have never really known, artists have never really known how to benefit from it. I think this is an issue, and I think that's why events like this are important, because in the UK and internationally, the majority of functioning gallery spaces are commercial. So if artists don't have the confidence, the knowledge, or the ability to engage with them in some way, then they're going to lose out on a huge percentage of potential exhibitions, collaborations, opportunities. The good thing, the reason for us to be optimistic, is that the agenda's changing. Funding agencies, well-established institutions are beginning to recognise that if artists, as long as artists better understand the commercial system, then not only will they be able to advocate for it, contribute to it, but they may even be able to guide friends, family, peers through a system which might seem at the moment something which is at least difficult to navigate. In that way, artists are increasingly becoming not just potential beneficiaries, but mediators, translators, facilitators for the commercial experience, or should be. Going back to what Louisa was saying about the growth in visibility for artist-led projects and success of artist-led projects, I'm lucky enough to partner on a fairly regular basis with artist-led organisations across the country. And there is a renewed mood of optimism, not just because of increased levels of public support and acknowledgement of the need for development of markets, development of investment across the UK, but also because they are seeing real benefits from doing it for themselves, if you will. They're seeing real relationships, real knowledge being gained from actually going out there and saying, well, I'm not going to wait for the money to come to me, whether public or private. I'm actually going to call round people, knock on doors, advertise, whatever it takes. That's happening in London too. I'd say even despite the recession, there's been a growth of artist-led, not-for-profit profit spaces right across the capital. But it's always going to be slightly more difficult because of the much greater cost of living, rents and associated overheads. So it's something that will hopefully, touch wood, continue to grow, but probably not at the same rate as there's potential for outside of London. Going back to potential online exposure, the importance of the internet in furthering artists' careers, I think at the moment at least, it's a slightly tricky area. There are increasing numbers of profiling sites where you can sell your work springing up, and it is tempting for artists to get involved with as much as possible for the exposure and just to test the waters. Although I wouldn't actively argue against artists seeking social media and these kind of new evolving online platforms to promote their work, I think you just have to advise a certain level of caution. Because in the long term, even if you are getting people emailing you, contacting you, inquiring about your work, potentially buying your work, I know this will sound slightly contradictory, but you don't want to sell work too cheaply, and you don't, in a way, it's not necessarily to your advantage to lose too much work too soon. There may be large works, seminal works, things that have helped you develop your understanding of who you are as an artist, that if they get bought, get shipped off to another city, another country, and you subsequently lose contact with that buyer, collector who contacted you, you may never see them again. And apart from the a digital image on your hard drive, there'll be very little to say they ever existed. I mean, also in terms of potentially working with an agent, a gallerist, it's obviously problematic if you have sold works, especially works which are significant within your canon, to people that you have very little or no further contact with. It may even have a negative impact on their decision to work with you, because from their point of view, there's always an inherent risk that anything they sell, or if they manage to gain you significant exposure, they manage to gain you significant sales, some of those earlier works will resurface, will circulate, and might be sold either to the wrong people or for the wrong amount, destabilising your market. So I think, to summarise, strangely, although we're in the midst of a financial war, currently suffering a financial downturn, a recession almost, there are a lot of headlines, there are a lot of negative headlines about the impact this is having on visual arts. I think in terms of artists doing it for themselves and their ability both to source local corporate sponsorship and hopefully in the long term public funding to support what they do, we're actually facing quite a positive period. That's the way that I'd like to look at it. Similarly, the internet, the online, many and various online platforms that exist, do provide increasingly interesting opportunities. But I think, you know, as it's already been said, it's going to be a very long time before they replace a physical relationship with an artist and with a work. And so any decision to get involved in a kind of online commerce needs to be taken very seriously and with a great deal of consideration.
Great. Thank you, Matt. I'm tempted to open up the to questions from the audience, but it might be a little bit early. Do people have any questions at this stage or not, based on the conversation that we've had? Any hands coming up? Okay, we do. Yes, great. Now I have to say that this is on my right. If you think I'm going slightly mad, it's because it's your right, not my right, and we need to give direction for the mic. This lady here. So.
Hi.
Your name? Also?
Sorry, yes, yeah. My name is Maria, and I work as a freelancer for a number of organizations. My question is about art fairs where artists exhibit, because that's becoming also an increasing phenomenon, like the Bloomsbury Art Fair, the other art fair. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on those and whether you would advise artists to try and exhibit and go at it on their own.
Great. Okay. I'll hand that to Louisa, I think, initially.
I think it's, as Kate said, it's about relationships, the art world. I mean, I actually wrote that on my piece of paper, and I don't think I did flag it up. So I think it's very important for you to look at the context of these art fairs. I think what Matt was saying as well about, you know, selling your work willy-nilly, you've got to be very careful. On the one hand, we've all got to live, we want to make a living, you want your work to be out there and be appreciated, but you've also got to make sure it's being sold in the right context and in the right environment. And I think, you know, certainly if you've looked at an art fair and you think it looks like a favourable place for your work, you will accrue good sales, but also you like the company that your art is keeping on whatever galleries you approach, then I think by all means go and do it. But I think that kind of context and those kind of relationships are very important, not just for you to have feel that you're working with the individuals concerned, but also that your art is in its own context.
Okay, Matt, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, art fairs can create a kind of a dialogue for your work. You know, you get a response which is very direct. You know, of course, there are some artists whose work sort of just doesn't really work in art fairs. And, you know, having tested that myself, it's, you know, there is a certain risk, and I sometimes have to be quite careful. And when you're planning ahead for an art fair, I mean, I always make a model now, but, you know, there have been times where I've thought, oh, maybe I wish I hadn't brought that work with me to the art fair. I wish I'd maybe kept that for a show. Or, but, you know, you make these decisions based on the current.
I mean, let's be honest, no art looks that great in an art fair.
No,
you know, however carefully you curate the stands and all this kind of, you know, this kind of preparatory work, really it's not the ideal context. On the other hand, it's great exposure, so you have to weigh up those pros and cons, I think.
I mean, there are so many new art fairs. I mean, I got the email today about the one at Olympia, which is quite a big thing, the fact that there's another art fair for contemporary art going to be happening in London. So despite a recession, they're popping up everywhere. And I mean, I think in Miami, there were one year there was 38. Is that, could that be true? I think it was. I mean, they were in hotels. But I think, you know, yeah, you treat them with caution, but they are a reality that, you know, can be useful. I mean,
I'm conscious that we've spoken a lot about galleries and art fairs and kind of those modes of commercial representation. But when we were speaking earlier in the week, Kate, you said how you're often talking to artists and saying, look, there are many ways to be represented, and actually galleries are not always right for artists. And
I mean, artists that I represent have sometimes, you know, they'll have funding for other things. I mean, I work with filmmakers and... you know, often to produce a project, they'll need to be specially commissioned, and that's not something I could pay for. But it might be a special project for something they're doing. I mean, you know, support for producing work comes from all places, and just getting a commercial gallery doesn't mean it's all sorted and your work starts selling. There are so many models, and actually, what's been interesting about the last few years, and I've kind of preferred this climate in some ways, is that I think we're all working a bit smarter. You know, I think probably out of this, you know, better art is coming out as well. Having a commercial gallery is not the sort of the be all and end all. And I think the artists that really thrive have that attitude as well, is that, you know, I act as an agent, I'm there to help, but I can't do everything. And you know, I can be one part of a story.
There's not a stigma about being entrepreneurial now, is there,
no,
in a way?
No,
I mean,
no.
There was a sort of feeling, again, perhaps when I first started emerging into the art world, that you sort of had to wait to be discovered, you know, some sort of pinstripe arm would, you know, descend from the heavens and point at you, and you'd be whisked off to Cork Street, as it then was, to the height of it all.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, artists, and then of course that was the whole much mythologized Frieze show with the Goldsmiths gang putting on their own shows and all that. But, I mean, which is the other polar opposite. But I think artists are generally more entrepreneurial. And as you say, Kate, you can be represented by a gallery, but you can also get funding for a project. You can be commissioned.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of different models that can actually operate simultaneously. It's not a kind of either-or situation anymore.
I think, I totally agree, Louisa, that maybe 10 years ago... if you're a curator or an artist and you talked about other aspects of your practice, things you'd been doing, people would think in some way that was drawing away. Well, why can't you just be an artist? Why can't you just be a curator? Now, if you put your CV in for something or you put in your hat in the ring for something, you have to demonstrate the ability to fundraise, to negotiate, to manage relationships. And now we... certainly don't punish artists for being able to do the same. In some instances, we even reward it, respect an ability to generate their own opportunities, support themselves.
I'd like to ask Kate to talk a little bit about the kind of model, how the commercial representation model of galleries, the traditional one, has sort of changed. And in particular, you know, so many artists, so many galleries now are spending so much time at art fairs that the traditional role of their space to show, to create a critical context for their work. The work of the artist that they represent is now becoming increasingly not redundant, but it's more difficult to achieve. Can you just talk a bit about that and what that might mean for artists and maybe other panelists also?
I think actually the solo show in the gallery is still, people are really still judged on that, and I think that's really good. You do your first show with an artist and people watch, and then if the second show is, you know, the work's moved on, I think you do still get judged on the solo show, and I think an art fair can help. There's chemistry involved and it moves things along, but I don't think, unless you maybe do a solo project or something, you know, I think people still judge artists on their solo exhibitions, which I'm pleased about. And that's what I like about the business, is that actually, like I mentioned it, is that, you know, quality does come out. And, you know, if you see, you know, I don't think there's sort of nothing worse than going to an art fair where you see one artist on 8 different stands. You know, I think that's a bit unfair on the artist. I hope that's the case. I feel like that, you know, that's what you get the reviews for. You don't really get reviews for a good art fair stand.
But I think, yes, it's the fact, isn't it, that, you know, if you're working in the primary market, as you say, you're an artist agent, it's more important to you to manage your artist's career than it is to flog the work to the highest bidder. You know, that's what auctions do. And I think that's a crucial distinction, because we haven't really talked about, I mean, it's perhaps not relevant to this evening, but, you know, the fact that the auction house is another development over the last kind of decade is the way in which auction houses have tried to sort of steal the march on the private, on the dealers. So therefore they work with private clients, they have private sales, of course in some cases Viz Haunch of Venice, and they actually own commercial galleries, and there's this whole kind of sort of smoke and mirrors, so that the pre-sale shows are curated, but of course they're not, they're what they managed to get consigned for the show. So there's that sort of dynamic, but bottom line is whoever puts the paddle up gets the work, whereas of course you're doing something completely different. And I think that, you know, that a good gallerist, and I use the word gallerist advisedly, not dealer, actually does do that. And I think that often gets overlooked in the mix somehow. You know, you're seen as these sort of, you know, hard-nosed, black-suited sort of... I'm doing a lot of suiting tonight with my pinstripe and my black, but, you know, there's this sort of sense of, you know, you're there as you sort of, you know, to give the work to the highest bidder and do strange adjustments to the prices, so different people get different price points, and it's all unregulated, and what the hell's going on anyway. Whereas, actually, I think, you know, you're there really to look out for your artist.
You do that as best you can. I mean, sometimes, you know, also, you know, artists need to be financially supported, so you have to make that call, and often that's done with the artist. So at an art fair, you might say, look, we've had interest from this and this, which way do you want to go? And it's a discussion I might have. Some artists don't want to have that conversation. They want to leave it completely to me. Some artists want to know where their work's going. So it's a case-by-case basis. Again, it's about relationships.
There's just one observation I want to make, and then we'll, I think, open up to the floor, because I'm conscious Jelaine would like to ask a question. But the other thing I'm really aware of is the role in particular, the close relationship between institutions and the way that commercial galleries are often funding key public programmes in some areas, or where they're looking to work with galleries that are able to subsidise their programming in lieu of this reduction of public subsidy. And is this something that, what are the implications of that for artists, for example, that are not represented, and or galleries that can't afford to do that?
I think, you know, initially, I'd say that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, when the recession first really started to take hold, I was slightly worried by the amount of commercially represented artists and commercial galleries logos that were appearing on touring institutional or major institutional shows. I don't think that now I'm slightly more at home with it, because this is the way that the new international institutions and even some pre-existing international institutions have worked for a long time. They don't have the level of public subsidy that we do, so they've always relied on patrons, collectors, or commercial galleries to effectively support the major shows. It's not a problem as long as there are new or emerging curators, facilitators, organisations that are able to support the unrepresented artists, or at least advise them, help them towards representation if that's something they're interested in along the way. So as long as funding and to some extent those institutions that are benefiting from the corporate and commercial sector are also investing time and energy in supporting the unrepresented artists, then it's not as big a problem as it could be.
I still do think it is a problem, though, actually. I mean, frankly, I really do. I think when you're a really strong... It's not so much with the biggies like Tate. I know I made my cheeky remarks about Peter Doig, but, you know, it's not so much the big ones. It's when you're out of town, it's the regional galleries struck for cash, and then perhaps, you know, somebody decides one of their artists could do with some public endorsement, because don't forget the crucial thing about public shows is an endorsement for the artist. You can have billions of commercial shows, but if you haven't got a few public shows dotted around your CV, you soon start to look quite shabby in comparison to the ones who have. So you want the endorsement, and you haven't got much money, and along comes, you know, a decently well-heeled gallery and goes, you know what, we'll subsidise the catalogue, we'll design it, we'll get so-and-so to write the catalogue essay, we'll get so-and-so collector to lend the work, and we'll ship it from Miami or whatever. It's very hard not to go, thanks very much. So I think that there is that problem.
Okay, we're going to open up to the floor now because there are lots of questions mushrooming up. So I'm going to start with my good friend Jelaine, who was the first to put her hand up. So
I'm just following on really on what Louise has just said and also partly what Matt said, which is how do you break this closed shop? Because one of the things that's changed enormously since I started in the art world is that, you know, in the old days, commercial galleries used to come and look at public spaces like yours. We worked together some time ago, Kate. And then that validation would happen exactly as you said in the public space. Now, you know, when Frieze Art Fair opens, you know, early morning opening for Tate to buy works from the booths, not even of the artist's work, but actually from the booths, which is subsidised by a hedge fund, you know, collector, I think we have to ask the question about how people can break this closed shop. And loads of artists come to me and say, and I say, you know, and they are entrepreneurial, and they are doing stuff, and they're cataloguing their work, and they've set up their websites, and they're inviting curators to come to their studios, but they can't get through this validation stamp of approval. They don't know how to get that validation stamp of approval, and it applies equally to public institutions as it does to commercial institutions in terms of how they get their foot through the door and get validated.
It's a really complicated ecosystem. I think you've got to be written about, you've got to be exhibited, you've got to be in mixed. I mean, as I'm thinking, okay, so I'm doing a sort of an imaginary trajectory, but a young artist perhaps coming out of art school, it's the model that I flagged up at the end of my talk about artist-run spaces, artist-run residences, initiatives taken in that way. That awful word networks, that word relationships, it is to be entrepreneurial, to get yourself seen in a space. Also, a lot of institutions now are working much more with the residency model, with the artists, with the project-based model. I'm thinking of Barcelona, I'm thinking of actually of Tate as well, and other spaces. I think working also, I'm thinking South London Gallery also have close affiliations with artist-run studios. I mean, there's only a certain amount of public spaces that are available for artists to show within. But I do think also curators are very aware, particularly after all this boomy stuff has been going on, that they begin to look really tawdry and really kind of bought if they don't interject a bit of grit, a bit of unendorse, as it were, into their mix. And I think that is a conscience. There also is a conscience amongst the collectors as well in their quasi-institutional spaces to be seen to be supporting artists. I think the problem more is with the middle career artist, almost, because I think it's quite sexy to have young artists in your space, whether you're public or a collector. It's also not that expensive to buy, relatively speaking. I think the problem more is the kind of middle-aged sector where perhaps the artists might have fallen off the endorsement ecosystem. But I mean, it is complicated, and I think it is case by case, but I think that, you know, it's not all gloom and doom, but I do think a lot of plugging still has to be done.
Great, okay, we'll take another question. Yes, the lady over there on the right.
Thank you.
Not very good. Yes, a couple there.
At this point.
Hello, yeah, exactly.
I think I have to say mic man that it's on the right. So, okay, the lady at the back.
Thank you.
Can you say
I'm
your
Christine
name,
Captain, and I am the curator at the University for the Creative Arts, which is not to be confused with the University of the Arts in London. They are our main competitor. We have 5 campuses outside London. I was very intrigued by what Louisa Buck said about the art dealers, the commercial galleries, supporting public exhibitions in order to get validation, I suppose, which I think we all know, for their artists. To me, the experience has been exactly the opposite. I'm opposed to take the second art dealer in my career to court, because actually I think art dealers use the public system to actually get free funding for their artists. And I think that one of the problems is with the system is that artists, curators, are not aware of how the system really works. And I would like to push this point, because I think it's very important that we become more historically aware about what the public system means, in which I thoroughly believe, but I've always wanted to actually work with the commercial system in order to benefit the arts, with woeful results. So I think really there's a lot of myth-making going on in these places. Yeah, I mean, commercial galleries are about profit and assets, yeah, and I know that, I've studied business, and artists are about their career, and I think they need to be much more savvy about how both systems work. That's the point I'd like to make. Thank you.
Very interesting point. Are there any other questions? There was a here on the lady in the white cardigan on the right.
Hi. I was just wondering...
Can you say who you are?
Colette. And I'm a publicist. I was just wondering, we've been talking about art fairs and things like that, and we've been talking really about art fairs at the top of the game, which is the 1%, you know, of people that can actually afford to go to Frieze or RHK, which is coming to London this year. But I'd like to sort of think about right at the bottom with the artists that are coming out of college. Do you think maybe the market is actually saturated now with artists and there's just not enough collectors out there to keep it going? Because I'm finding galleries, from personal experience, they're getting quite fed up of artists phoning them up and asking them to look at their work, because they're too busy at the moment looking after their own stable of artists, and they don't want to take a risk of somebody new coming in and upsetting the apple cart, as it were.
Okay, I'll let each panelist actually respond to that. I think it's an important question. Louisa, do you want? Is there?
I think it's a very valid observation, and I think I haven't got the numbers to crunch, but I know they work out that, you know, the quantity of artists, people who work actually making a living, or even almost a living from being an artist, compared to the amount of graduates from art school every year, is just, you know, hugely disproportionate, and it is a problem. But I still think what Kate said is true, is that good work will out, you know. I mean, there is an awful lot of art coming out, and perhaps some of it isn't going to make the final grade of being represented. And I think, you know, if an artist is really good and plugs at what they do, good work will out, good work will get shown.
Kate.
Well, the problem is, of course, with the current funding system,
yeah,
is that, you know, a lot of people whose mummies and daddies can afford to pay the fees, and indeed, if I won't spend all evening ranting about my feelings about internships, but, you know, the fact that the art world runs on free labour, which I think is really appalling as well, is a huge problem, because obviously, you know, the really brilliant kid who potentially brilliant kid from a very poor background might not even get past the starting block, might not even be able to go there. It is a problem. It's a matter of quality, I think, as well as quantity.
Kate.
Well, I studied fine art, and I know that when I graduated in 92, I think there were 8 of us in my year group, and I know that now there's 45 or something in that course. So I think we're well known for it, the UK. A lot of people want to come to art college in London, in the UK. It's a big thing, and I think there are a lot of expectations that cannot be met. I mean, I'm quite wary of this entrepreneurial get-up-and-do-it-yourself type approach, actually. And I think the YBAs did it, and it's not going to work for everybody. I think it's quite tricky. I don't know. I mean, I'm torn because, of course, we were talking the other day about galleries in South London. Apparently, there's 150 new galleries in South London. I don't know if that's quite right, but there is a lot of energy out there, and I think that doesn't have to be that doesn't have to come out in commercial representation. I think good work will come out, but I think to a certain extent, I think there is quite a lot of, you know, I wasn't really taught much in art school, and I don't know what people were taught here, but I didn't really have any sort of lessons on... What's that? Yeah, well, there wasn't... I didn't have any kind of career guidance. And you know what? It's something I'm quite grateful for now, actually.
Yeah, I've got a real problem with all this talk about... Yeah. You know, when I started out in the art world, no one talked about having a career as an artist. They made art, you know.
In a way, I think there's something in that, you know... Artists also want to get on with their practice, and I don't know the answer to this bigger question of how does artists get a gallery. I can't answer it myself, and I have a gallery. I don't really know, but it's a sort of dangerous territory, and I think it's fed by the fact that the art schools are bursting, and you know, people are coming from all over the world. They're paying a lot of money to come to art school, and there isn't the room for everyone. Knowing how many collectors there are out there, we're all fighting over the same collectors. But maybe, you know, maybe what's interesting is that isn't the way forward for survival of artists. We have to find new models.
Matt, do you want to say something briefly?
Then? Yeah. It's a difficult one. We have one of the biggest sectors in the world. You know, there's a good 2,500 galleries in the UK. The problem is there's, according to AN and various other sources, 28,500 artists roughly competing for those places, for those exhibitions, for representation or commercial relationships. So invariably, it's not impossible to build a career, but it takes a long time. It takes a long time just to understand who those organisations are, what they do, and how they might relate to you, let alone to build the relationships that actually, you know, can generate the opportunities. There are other countries where they have less graduates, significantly less graduates, and so they have a healthier ecosystem of artists to opportunities, but then because they don't have the public profile, or because their art scenes are younger, they don't have the potential for earnings, they don't have the potential for international opportunities that artists who manage to build a significant career here do. So I think it's a long game, it's a marathon, it's a sprint basically. And anyone can do it, but it takes a lot of time and knowledge.
Great, okay. Any more questions? The lady here on the right, on the left.
Hi, my name's Fleur. I'm currently in the process of setting up a gallery. I don't know whether it's going not-for-profit or commercial, I'm not sure. But I wondered whether there's scope for an entirely different model of an art gallery, one which is not kind of aiming at the white cube model of how much can we sell and sell it faster, but something that maybe relies on a social enterprise model of mutuals, community shares, artists actually coming together and selling their art in a slightly different kind of way where they all put money into the pot to kind of keep a gallery going so that you've got space, and also using entirely different pieces of agreements that you can get nowadays. I've got my gallery space for about maybe 6 months on a Meanwhile lease, which is something where I am paying minimal rent because there's a scheme to kind of like... in my high street, shops are kind of decimated, so they're trying to use empty spaces. So I wondered what you thought about the pop-up galleries and a slightly different way of working as a gallery and as artist collectives.
Great. Okay, Kate, do you want to take that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think new models are what we need. I mean, what I would say from a personal point of view is that you need a strong group of artists that have a good understanding to make that work over a long period of time. And maybe if you built into it that it could be refreshed, that might actually work better. I think at the end of the day, something that I feel is sort of necessary for building artists' careers is stability, sustainability. Being in one place, people know where to come if they want to talk to you about an artist. And so you know, that's a big job for someone. And it may not be a job the artists want to do. But I think that a lot of galleries, including commercial galleries, not necessarily mine, but they come out of the ethos that you're talking about. I mean, a lot of the artists I represent came out of a group of friends. I was the only one amongst them that wasn't an artist, but I kind of saw an opportunity to represent them as a bit of a group. And that group's moved a bit and changed, and new people came that weren't part of that group. But I think that group activity can lead to something. And it's quite nice not knowing what that might be. So I would say, you know, if you have a strong group that have a mutual understanding, then go for it.
Kate, I've heard you talk often actually about the role that artists play in recommending other artists for representation and that being a very influential advocacy through those kind of networks of artists.
Yeah, I mean, I've met most of my artists through other artists. I mean, that's, people ask, you know, how do you find artists all the time? And that's probably one of the, that's a very strong way that it happens, and the model you're talking about could allow that to happen. But also, without having regular rent, you give yourselves, if you've got cheap rent, you know, you don't have the same responsibilities. You can be quite fluid with it and do projects. I mean, sounds great.
Great. Okay, we have a question from Klaus at the back here on the right.
Yeah, hello. My name is Klaus. I'm a visual artist. I was just thinking, this whole talk about how do you succeed as an artist, is that the Nobel-winning economist in economics, Daniel Kahneman, he did a lot of research on success, and actually his equation is success is down to hard work plus luck. And I don't know if you have any comments on that as a panel, that it's actually down to luck, quite frankly.
I think there's a lot to be said. I mean, there's also the Thomas Edison quote about, you know, inspiration or genius is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration, you know, and I would add a sort of bolt of luck up that as well. I think it's very true. Things happen, people come together, certain confluences of personalities, either in your artist space or in Goldsmith's Art School or Kate's Gallery, you know, people form relationships. It is a random fluid thing, and that's what makes, I think that's also why the art world isn't regulated, because it does operate in this kind of ad hoc, strange sort of way, and I think luck has a huge part to play, yes.
Great. Any other questions? The lady here on the right in the centre. Actually, we prefer the mic because it's being recorded. Thanks.
Hello. Yeah, my name's Nancy. I'm editor of the Guardian Culture Network, which is the Guardian's new community space for everyone working in arts and heritage, covering the back end of the arts, really, all the issues we're talking about. Matt is one of our contributors, actually, and you should read his articles. one of the things I wanted to respond to, the lady over there who suggested new models for gallery spaces. There's actually new models for buying, too. I've written an article about a group called The Collective, who are people who you may or may not know, start as friends, sort of open up a bank account together, put money into it, and buy art as groups, which they then share around their homes. It's operating in London, in Bristol, in Birmingham.
Is that Tim Eastop?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, it's small, but it suggests there's an appetite on both sides for new models. And they're people who want to engage not just in buying art, but talking to the artists and nurturing those relationships. So people perhaps should seek that out a bit and perhaps even start their own. But also, just the network word in general, we're called a network because we're trying to connect people up together. And we've had quite a series of articles about how, while the internet is a tool, it's also profoundly changing how people operate, and that the whole old hierarchies are being chucked out. And there may be a point at which this really affects the art world too. I know money speaks, and so the money at the top of the chain is always going to do a lot. But I think we can't ignore the way that the internet is going to change how we do things and the power it's giving to big groups of people. It's not just a tool. And I wish it were sometimes. I'm not a digital native. I've grown up without the internet and had to take it on. But really talk to young people about how they operate, because they're going to be the next generation of art buyers and artists too. I don't know what you think about that.
Speaking as an ancient person who's always getting annoyed with her daughter for being on Facebook all the time, but, you know, even I've penetrated that. I mean, I think that, you know, Facebook groups, the amount of interface I have with artists on Facebook, the way in which people can form communities, it's a really valid model. And, I mean, they're quite long-standing collecting models too. Vanessa Branson did the Wonderful Fund, all sorts. I mean, it is true, you've still got to have that surplus income though, so I'm afraid money does kind of speak in that respect. But I think also the artist groups forming associations of like-minded like-minded people to make installations, to go. I'm thinking of Aid and Abet in Cambridge, for example, which I think is a really interesting model. So you don't have to be just there to flog it or just there to be kind of a project space. You can combine these models and mesh them. But yes, I think you're completely right. The internet is, it's just that VIP, it's not a substitute for an art fair. It's another model altogether.
Can I invite this gentleman here? We'll, if you would wait just for the mic for a moment.
Hello.
Recording you, I'm afraid.
David Taylor, artist, multimedia, casting, all that sort of stuff, glass. Rental market, I think that could be expanded. I don't know what your thoughts on that are, but it's like lowering the price for people to buy, well, not sorry, to buy, to rent for a year or 6 months or whatever. I was thinking that market could really be pushed somehow. I don't know how. The other thing I wanted to ask was agents. How do you find them? How do you persuade them to? There must be some kind of thing, maybe just ideas that you might have about how to actually go about, you know, doing it. Do they have clubs? Do they have clubs in London?
No.
Agents clubs?
Finding agents, but what about rentals? Do we think renting art, that there's an opportunity for artists to be supported through renting art? Matt?
There are, I don't want to misrepresent them, but I think Rise Art is an organisation which has started offering art for rent. One of our team actually had a placement working for a production. I'm not sure exactly how you would term them, but basically what they did was they bought contemporary art and rented it to films, television programmes, productions, which is another kind of alternative way of bringing money into the sector. I think it has a place because, or could potentially have a place, because anything that puts art in people's home, that gets them used to talking about art, seeing art, talking about artists to their friends, is a good thing. But art is, not all of it, but some of it is relatively affordable. So you can support an early career artist for a few hundred pounds, maybe even, you know, £50, £100. So it's not... It's just... part of the kind of a new system that's coming in.
Mm-hmm. Kate, do you want to say anything?
Well, I've never done it myself, but I think it seems to me that it would really work in a commercial sector like city banks and things wanting to have a collection on the walls but not wanting to look after the work long term, which, let's face it, is an expensive thing to do. It's, you know, once you buy a work of art, it's not over. And the model you mentioned about sharing works as well, I know that groups that have got together and shared works, actually swapping it round so they all have a go at each having it in their house is a logistical nightmare, really, I think, in the end. So, you know, but I think, you know, any way that can bring a street income stream for artists. But I think essentially, I don't know whether it would work in people's homes, really, but I think it probably would end up being, again, a commercial thing in the commercial sector with companies.
It's probably
but
worth
yeah, mentioning. I think there are agents that do it. I can't remember the name, but there is an agent that does rent a something. Yeah, there is an agency
art.
That does it. I know.
And of course, museums
it's probably a good market,
have been having loan art schemes for years. Of course, although some of those are drying up in the current climate, where parts of their collection are available for loans by audiences. So. Louisa, do you want to add anything to that?
I haven't got a huge amount to add to it, really. I think I think what Kate says is right, is that it's more of a commercial thing than a private thing, because I know that when you do have bands of people putting in money into a pot to buy work, and then suddenly, you know, one of the artists they've bought rockets in value, and suddenly somebody needs a new car, or their kids need their teeth fixed or something, and they're like, oh, let's liquidate this asset, you know, we need the ready... It can be quite complicated, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just involves a commitment to do it properly. I think that's the thing.
But for those of you that are interested in these collective, individual models, it is called The Collective, and they have a website, and you can get involved with them. And it's run by Tim Eastop, who is very well known, I think, to all of us. So is there any final question? OK, one final question, and then I think we should wrap things up. So the lady here on my left.
I'm feeling the pressure now.
Can you say who you are?
Yes, my name is Miriam Metlis. I'm working at Visiting Arts at the moment and also work freelance with Latin American art. I just wanted to ask quite a practical question in terms of the market and prices. And who really sets the prices in the market? And how should we be setting the prices, whether you're an artist, a dealer, work in the primary market or the secondary market? Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that could be a very long answer, I should imagine. But Louisa, do you want to say something?
I think Kate should. Kate sells it.
Okay. I mean, yeah, it seems like quite a mysterious process from the outside. I mean, I always say to collectors if they're buying things, you know, look. I mean, this is from one point of view, but look at what an artist has done, because I think you do get crazy prices attached to artists sometimes. Just, you know. Because a dealer or someone might be kind of cashing in on a popularity. I think it's, you know, you never want to put your prices down. Your prices should only go up, so they have to go up incrementally. But I suppose the things that are at play when you decide a price is, you know, there are practical things like the production costs. What's this piece cost to make? That sometimes has a bearing. You can't get around that. Demand also has a bearing, there's no doubt about it. But again, I think it's to do with the sort of stages of your career as well. I try to use that as a model as well, because I think, you know, if, you know, I think you need to, and yeah, it's a kind of, sometimes crazy prices will be put on work that sort of hasn't really had a chance to breathe or stand the test of time. So it actually comes down to quite, it seems to be quite an exact science, but I know that'll make you all laugh, but it is, it's, the market kind of dictates it as well. You know, if stupid prices are put on something, you know, they don't sell. So it's quite a key.
But what happens if something suddenly rockets at auction, for example? One of your artists escapes into the the work gets away into the auction house, and two oligarchs, for want of a better word, whatever, decide they want it, and so they bid, up it goes for some crazy price, and that artist is having a show with you in the next 6 months. How do you handle that?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I've never had a direct experience of that going absolutely crazy. I mean, what's happened in this sort of boom and crash is that some artists that were reaching crazy prices at auction have completely gone back to where they sort of were before the boom. So it's a very dangerous sort of game to play. And these sort of crazy prices that go up for young artists don't tend to hang around. I mean, there's been some real examples, and it has a sort of dampening effect on the artist's career, because it's sort of the press about them is about their prices. So I think, you know, of what I know of bigger galleries where the prices have gone into hundreds of thousands for a young artist, you know, the galleries don't jump up and put the prices there. If there's sustained interest at auction and the prices are making that, then I think works rise to that. But, you know, I keep my head about those things. And auction can go well, it can go the other way. It's not, you know, you have to be careful to use it as too much of a bar. But, and I've had a few experiences with auction, but, yeah.
Great, okay. I'm very keen to give you all time at the bar and to meet each other and continue the conversation. So for now, I'd like to thank you all for being with us this evening, and to thank our panel, Matt Roberts, David Gary, and Louisa Banks.